There was a very interesting thing, review of the Life Divine, written by Amal Kiran, which describes his impression of the reading of the book, Life Divine, and says, after reading the book, one feels that the author of this book is also the author of the universe. Now, this sentence is very important because one of the ways by which one can read this book is to consider what is the drift of the argument of the whole book. How does it proceed? What is the method of argumentation? There is one word which might give some clue to this question. The design of the universe. It is as if we are asking our bewilderment, what is all this surrounding, very so much variety, so many creatures, so many mountains, rivers, gulfs, so much a bustle, and I don't understand if there is any design in this. Can there be any kind of a clue by which I can relate all this to each other? See the trend towards which all this is moving. Find out where we are, in what direction are we to move forward. What is all this here around? If you ask this question and then read the book, then the argument will seem to be flowing in a certain pattern. There are, as I had said earlier, many ways of expounding philosophy. And take, for example, this very question of the individual. If we are to study merely what is the individual, the exposition would be different. If you are asking the question, what is the destiny of the individual? The next position would be different. Although two are quite related to each other. But the drift of the book is the design of the world. The argument basically is, what is happening in this world? Why things are happening as they do? Is there any meaning in it? If so, what is the meaning? And it is in that context that it becomes inevitable to ask the question, what is the ultimate reality in the light of which all this is happening? So if the metaphysical book was simply what is the nature of the ultimate reality? The method by which the question can be detailed would be of one kind. But if the question is, what is the design of this world? Then many questions will remain common, but the drift of the argument will be different. And that is why when we read this book, with many preconceptions as to what philosophical books ought to be, then we may find bewilderment. The question about the destiny of the individual is connected with the design of the world. We are here on the earth. We are supposed to be doing something in this world. And we do not know what we are supposed to do. We do not know what is the direction in which we have to go. That is why the question of destiny of the individual becomes important. Now, this question is connected actually with the not only individual, but we started actually with the whole humanity. The whole humanity is aspiring, and that was the starting point. The whole humanity seemed to be moving forward, busy with something, and the question was, what is all this happening here? It is there that Sri Aurobindo takes up the question. And the whole book is in that context. So having grasped as to what is the humanity striving to do, and having found that what is humanity striving to do is connected with the ultimate reality, Sri Aurobindo has given in the fourth chapter a description of the ultimate reality, when he speaks of the omnipresent reality. And he says, unless you understand that nature of the ultimate reality, you won't understand why the humanity is doing what it is doing. And you won't understand why individuals are striving to do what they are doing. So having understood somewhat what humanity is striving to do, and how that striving is justified in the light of the nature of the ultimate reality, Sri Aurobindo comes closer to this question of what each individual is now striving to do, and what is his role to play in this world. It is in that context that this whole next three chapters are written. In fact, the main subject of all the three is the same. The individual. Here, destiny of the individual. Next is man in the universe. And third, ego and the dualities. All the three are centered on the question of the individual. You should take up a book like Ethics of Spinoza. This is one of the standard works of metaphysics. And if you see how that book begins, although the title of the book is Ethics, and in a sense you might say the purpose of the book is to tell the individual what you ought to be doing, it is in a sense something similar to the main purpose of this book. But the starting point of the book is the description of the ultimate reality. It starts with some definitions. It says that there is ultimately substance. Now you might say that he assumes that there is substance. But he starts with it, and he defines substance as that which exists in itself, and that which can be conceived through itself. That which exists in itself and it can be conceived through itself. This is the definition of substance. And ultimately he says, that substance is God. God is one who exists in itself and who can be conceived through itself. And he says this concept is incorrigible. You can't correct it further. This is his ontological argument. If you strain your thought and try to see what is the nature of thought, you will find that thought can only think of substance. At the highest level, thought can only think of substance. This is something like Parmenides, who said that it does not exist, cannot be thought of. Then what can you think of? That which exists. Now, if that existence is dependent upon some other existence, then you have to think of that. If it depends upon other existence, you have to think of that. Until you arrive at a point which exists by itself. So thought can rest only in that which exists in itself. And if it exists in itself, it can't be conceived through another thing. If it exists in itself, it can only be thought through itself. So he said this idea which I am presenting as a starting point is incorrigible. All metaphysical thought should start with this. The self-existence which can be thought only through itself and which thought can never deny. Therefore, according to him, to think is to think of God as self-existent. To think, that is to say, God is something that is the highest that thought can envisage. There is nothing more, nothing less. God is the only thing of which you can envisage as the highest. Now this is supposed to be the most cogent starting point of metaphysical thought. Now, in a sense, you might say that Life Divine also begins with a statement of that kind. In the very first sentence, where Sri Aurobindo speaks, the earliest preoccupation of man is also the highest that the thought can envisage. He is also the highest that thought can envisage. But the drift is different. He speaks of this in the context of finding what is mankind doing on this earth. What is the drift of this mankind? What is the design of this world? So in a sense you might say it's a larger question, in which metaphysics or the ultimate reality is only a kind of a consideration of a part of the problem. Of course, it is that in the light of which you can understand what the world is doing. That is why it is fourth chapter which gives a description of the omnipresent reality. Let's not start with it. It is at the fourth chapter that Sri Aurobindo gives us the idea of the omnipresent reality. And Sri Aurobindo does not give the description of the omnipresent reality merely in terms of what can be thought. He gives a description of ultimate reality, or omnipresent reality, in the context of what can be experienced at the highest. So it is not merely something which can be thought, but which can be verified in experience. That is why, in a sense we might say, ontological argument can be criticized only on one basis. That in thought you cannot doubt God. But God may not be existing. And that you can disprove only by saying that in experience also God exists. It's not only the highest that thought can envisage. God is also, when you try to examine the experiences, at the highest level of experience, of course, it's not ordinary experience. In ordinary experience, you can never experience God. So Sri Aurobindo has prepared the ground saying that it is only when you endow your experience that you can ultimately arrive at an experience of the omnipresent reality. In a sense, therefore, he has shown that that which is highest in thought is also the highest in experience. In that sense, you might say that one cycle of the argument is completed, and now we are moving on the second lap of the journey. But the second lap of journey has a connection with the starting point. It is a consideration of understanding the design of this village. And this design, having seen the ultimate reality as it is, we are trying to relate that reality with all that we are seeing. If reality is Satchidananda, as it has been said so far, it is omnipresent, it is that which is the supreme. And he says this supreme is indefinable because whatever word you use are inadequate. You experience it as a pure existence. You can even experience it as non-existent. And yet you can see of still Paratpara as a transcendental. You see it as active, you see it as inactive. Inactive, active reality. Sat is the nature of the ultimate reality. Now Sri Aurobindo, in the first paragraph of this chapter, he summarizes their starting point. So let us read first of all this first paragraph. An omnipresent reality is the truth of all life and existence, whether absolute or relative, whether corporeal or incorporeal, whether animate or inanimate, whether intelligent or unintelligent, and in all its infinitely varying and even constantly opposed self-expressions, from the contradictions nearest to us, to our ordinary experience, to those remotest antinomies, which lose themselves on the verges of the ineffable, the reality is one and not as some or concourse. From that all variations begin. The reality is one and not as some or concourse. This sentence is very important. There is a view that reality is whole. This statement is different from saying reality is one. And this makes a lot of difference in metaphysics. Let me go back to Spinoza. According to Spinoza, the substance which exists by itself must be capable of explaining everything else. Because everything else must depend upon that it exists in itself. All that exists must be a part of that. You see the transition. All can be explained in terms of that it exists by itself. Now the argument is, but all must be part of that. Now the moment you use the word part, it means the reality must be But if you say reality is one, which explains all, it's a different kind of state. And Sri Aurobindo says, the reality is not a sum, is not a concourse, is not mingling of all together and making one full apple. What is the nature of that reality, which is omnipresent, is everywhere. It is omnipresent, but it is that which has spread everywhere. It is not constituted by all. It constitutes all. This is the distinction between what is called pantheism and theism. According to pantheism, the totality of the world is the whole, that whole is God. God is nothing but all put together. So that you can say, all is God, or God is all. Theism maintains that reality is also transcendental. All is only the manifestation or expansion, but that which is expanded is in itself unmanifest and can remain unmanifest. That was the meaning when we said reality is inactive in itself. Yet it expands into activity. The two are not contradictory of each other. But if you don't say reality is transcendental of all, you are reducing reality only to all. When you say reality is transcendental, it means that it is a source of all. But it is not itself the creation of all, it's not constituted of all. It constitutes all. The omnipresent reality is a reality which is transcendental, and yet it is immanent, and not only immanent, but it is also all. So, according to theism, God is both transcendental and immanent. But according to this theory, which we are now studying, reality is transcendental, immanent, and also all.
Universal.
Yes, so that pantheism and this theism are both reconciled. According to theistic philosophy, basically Christian philosophy is theistic philosophy, God is everywhere in the world, but God is not the world.
Spirit is all.
Huh?
Only the spirit is in the world.
Yeah, but God is only spirit, therefore we can say spirit is in all, but it is not itself the all.
In substance, it is not in all.
It is not itself the all. Now, these distinctions are really necessary to understand because the speciality of this Vedantic philosophy is really grasped. There are three concepts of ultimate reality in the history of thought: deistic theory, pantheistic theory, and theistic theory. According to deistic theory, God is transcendental. and he is not at all present in the world. He creates the world, but leaves the world as it is. He commands over it. He is a judge who sits upon every faculty. But he himself is not present in the world.
Deistic.
It is. Divine is not only supracosmic according to that theory, but also extracosmic. He is outside the world. Not only above the world, but also outside the world. Reality is extracosmic.
So Christianity is deistic? No,
it is theistic. It is theistic, but it wavers. You see, theoretically it says God is both transcendental and also in the universe.
Christianity.
But since it is not also all, it's not pantheistic at all, then what happens? In a certain sense, he is extracosmic. In a certain sense. This is one of the very important distinctions which you will come across even in this chapter itself. What is the nature of the ultimate reality? According to theism, as I said, God is both transcendental and immanent. But by being immanent, God is still somewhat different from all. In that sense, it is extracosmic. There is something in him which is different from there. According to deism, God is not present at all in the world. God is entirely extracosmic. It's purely deistic.
Who would be an example of deism? I mean, which theology, theosophy?
All religions today are theistic. Which we know. In the historical development of religions, there was at one time an idea that God creates the world, but He's not in the world. He leaves the world to be ruled by its own laws.
So the prehistoric atheist.
There are many other religions also which are not prominently there. And as I said, even the theistic God is in a sense deistic, in so far as it says that it is in all, but it's not all. So in certain respect it is outside the world. But there are theories where it says that God is only a judge. He sits outside the world. He does not participate in the world. This is where Christianity, when it developed its own theory, it pointed out that God plays a role in history of mankind. God not only presides over the world, but He enters into the world. That is why Christ is a historical devil. So, immanence of God is shown by the fact that Christ is immanent and God plays a role in the shaping of the world. He is not only a judge above the world, He even comes down in the world, helps the world, opens the gates to God. He plays an immanent role. So according to theism, God is both transcendental and immanent. According to pantheism, God is not transcendental at all. It is all. All is God. God is nothing but all that you see, but put together. Now the Vedantic Advaita synthesizes all the three. Deism, theism, pantheism. God in a sense is transcendental. As Sri Krishna says in the 9th chapter, they are all in me, but I am not in them. So there is something in reality which self transcends. And yet by saying that the world is also himself, God is immanent. And God is all in that sense, but it is not confined only to that statement. In other words, as we have seen several times, reality as described in Advaita is at once Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara. These three words indicate all that is to be said about omnipresent reality. It is Brahman in the sense it is the essence. Now by its definition, essence must be that which transcends its manifestation.
That which transcends manifestation.
If it is essence, even if all manifestation is reduced to zero, that essence remains. The very notion of essence means essence is by nature transcendental. But the very nature of essence means that it is he who spreads everywhere.
Both.
It is both. So Brahman is a concept which says the essence, the very word Brahman is what? Etymologically, the word Brahman is that which moves out, which expands. That's the very meaning of the word Brahman, that which expands. So Brahman is that essence which expands.
Can it also be said that Brahman is the substance then?
Yes. Is the fundamental substance. But the word substance has become very ambiguous. So one will not use that word substance in that sense. You can say the Brahman is a self-existence. What the definition of Spinoza, that which exists in itself, he calls it substance.
Spinoza called
it. He calls it substance. He starts with the definition of substance. So, Brahman is that which is the essence and which expands. Purusha is that who enters into expansion. He is not only expansion, but he also enters into expansion. He is the one whose vasa, vas, the word Purusha is nothing but pur plus push. Yes, so pur is the field, expansion. Push is vas, that which
stays.
They dwells.
Push.
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 Push is vas. You know, in Sanskrit, vu and va have a relationship.
Yes. In Sandhi, it is a niyam.
Yes. So, the word Purusha is actually the one who dwells, vasati. सह यह वसति पुरी सपुरुषः दैट विच लिव्स इन द फील्ड इज पुरुष. So you will find in expressions in the Life Divine very often that transcendental has entered into the form. It's a very important expression that transcendental or the reality or the supreme has entered into the form. Form is not only that which has expanded from itself, but he has also entered into it. And it is that who rules over it. Ishvara. He is not only one who dwells in it, but also rules over it. He rules over it and who enjoys it. Because his very nature is delight. In expansion he is joyful. In dwelling in the form he is joyful. In ruling he is joyful. Like Sri Krishna moving about everywhere mischievously. Because he rules over the world and nothing is beyond him. So, you might say like a dictator fiat moving about anywhere. Any problem that you propose to him, he has a solution to it. So, it's a quality of the Ishvara, who is Lord of everything. You go to him and say, give me this, he'll give you the Tathastu. Because he can give it, and nobody else can give. That is why it is said, whom are you begging in this world? Those who can never give. Why don't you go to him? He's the only one who can give. Why gopis should go after him? Because he's the only one who can give them what they want. Nobody else can give anything. Only he can give. And that is the highest teaching actually. The highest secret. As Sri Aurobindo says, if one knows how to be profited in this world, he should see only one thing. Don't go about begging here, there, which all we are doing in this world. We are begging the world. And begging of those who can never give. You beg of him who can give, really. He is Ishvara, he is himself the expanding power, he is all. He is a true joy. And that is why the first sentence of the Ishopanishad, Isha vasyam idam sarvam yatkincha jagatyam jagat. All that is in the world is the habitation, Isha vasya, for the Lord. Actually, we are thinking that we are actually habiting, but it is vasya, it's not vasati, vasya. This is the whole world which is for the habitation. It's not his habitation. All this is here is for the habitation of the Lord. Therefore, if you want to enjoy, leave it to him. Tena tyaktena vanjita. Therefore, if you really want to enjoy, leave it to him. Give everything to him. That's the only secret of enjoyment. Otherwise you will never enjoy anything unless you do that. It is his property.
Don't be attached to it.
So you are coveting everything, but it's actually his.
Don't try to covet it.
Yeah, don't try, it is his. It is his. So why do you want to covet his property? When you give it up to him, everything is yours. This is the concept in the Upanishad, this is the concept in the Veda, and this is the concept in the what is called Vedanta. All Vedanta describes reality as the essence which can expand and expands, and therefore he is all. He is in all, Purusha, and he rules over all, he is Ishvara. So he is described as Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara. And these three words are used in the Upanishads very carefully, but because we do not know the essential meanings of each one, we take them to be interchangeable. In a sense they are, but if you want to have a specific meaning of each, then you should say this reality in essence which expands into all, which dwells into all, and which lords over all. This is the nature of ultimate reality. And this is the omnipresent reality. And this is what Sri Aurobindo describes here in the first paragraph. I read again. And omnipresent reality is the truth of all life and existence, whether absolute or relative, whether corporeal or incorporeal, whether animate or inanimate, whether intelligent or unintelligent, and in all its infinitely varying and even constantly opposed self-expressions, from the contradictions nearest to our ordinary experience to those remotest antinomies which lose themselves on the verges of the ineffable, the reality is one and not a sum or concourse. From that all variations begin. In that all variations consist. To that all variations return. Now this word, all variations begin, is a very important expression. Reality is one, and therefore in ordinary sense, it is the same. Same. We might say reality is one, therefore the same. If it is one and the same, then it has no place for variation. But if you examine all the variations, you find nothing but that, as we had said yesterday, seven rays are nothing but that very white light. It is the same. And yet all variations start from it. It is the same. It is one and yet all. It is same and yet many. Now these seem to be contradictions. As Sri Aurobindo says, all the antinomies are all reconciled and they are all become, they become one in him. Such is the nature of reality. In fact, on this subject, there has been a tremendous debate in the whole history of philosophy. If reality is transcendental, how can it be ever immanent? If it is transcendental, how can it be all, not only immanent, but how can it be itself all? If it is one, how can it be all? If it is one, how can it be many? If it is inactive, how it can be active? If it is existent, how can it be non-existent? If it is free, how can it be bound? These are all antinomies. And as you have said yesterday, if white light is seven colors, if that is the nature of it, although by words they seem to be opposite of each other, but actually they are not opposite of each other. One and many are not opposite of each other, because when we say reality is one, what do we mean? What is the word meaning of the word one? Is it one which is more than zero and less than two? Then it can be many. If by one we mean one figure, this is one, it can be many. But is that the meaning? Then what to attend to the word one? When I say it is essence, what is the meaning of essence? If you reflect on the idea of essence, you find essence can be the essence only if it is more than essence. The concept of essence means, word essence has a meaning only if there is more than essence.
Was it to be the essence or something? No. Something?
Exactly. So, the very notion of essence itself says it is not one. It is more than one. Such is the very nature of reality. Therefore, one and all are not opposite of each other. Essence of all is one, is the same, is that essence, the Brahman. But it's also that which is all. The two words seem to be opposite in our language. But we must define, or we must start, try to find another language, as Sri Aurobindo says, that to be able to describe Vedanta, you require a different language. This language which you are using is not at all applicable to it. See, very beautifully, if you open this second chapter of the second volume, in the second paragraph of this chapter, in the middle, in order to express this experience,
the title is Brahman.
Udveshwara Kari. Second chapter, second paragraph. In the middle of the paragraph,
okay,
you have an expression. In order to express this experience, not got it?
Yes, okay.
In order to express this experience of this idea with any nearness, a language has to be created which is at once intuitively metaphysical and revealingly poetic, admitting significant and living images as the vehicle of a close, suggestive and vivid indication. A language such as we find hammered out into the subtle and pregnant massiveness in the Veda and Upanishads. In the ordinary tongue of metaphysical thought, we are to be content with a distant indication, an approximation by abstractions, which may still be of some service to our intellect. For it is this kind of speech which suits our method of logical and rational understanding. But if it is to be of real service, the intellect must consent to pass out of the bounds of a finite logic and accustom itself to the logic of the infinite. So this is the condition on which we use these words. Reality is one and then say, oh, it can't be all, but what do you mean by it? By one, we do not mean one that is more than zero and less than two. That's not the meaning of the one when we say it is essence. By one, we mean essence. Reality is not merely essence. It is always more than essence. Then only we can see it is essence. There is a beautiful sentence of Plato where he says, reality far exceeds essence in dignity and power. This is one of the best definitions of reality that we find in the Bible. Reality far exceeds essence, both in dignity and power. If by essence we mean the pure existence, then power is chit and dignity is ananda. So it means that Plato describes reality as Satchidananda. Exceeds essence. Essence is existence, sat. Both in power and dignity. And power is a word we use in India also only for this shakti. And dignity is fundamentally a word of ananda. All dignity is Aishwarya. All Aishwarya is the enjoyment, power of enjoyment. One who may be living in a big palace but does not enjoy it, there's not Aishwarya in it. Aishwarya is power of enjoyment, ananda. One who enjoys is ananda. So, Aishwarya is dignity. So Plato uses his own terms and he says reality far exceeds the essence. So it is essence, but it far exceeds the essence. And that's the meaning of essence. Essence means that which is always exceeded, both in power and dignity. So you might say that Plato ultimately, after all the surfing of the ocean of the world, he ultimately comes to realize that reality is essence, dignity and power, is Satchidananda. So this very word Satchidananda itself is a complex term. It's not a simple term. Sat, Chit, Ananda, three are clubbed together. This is the marvel of the Sanskrit language. It created a language in which three words are put together. It is acceptable in Sanskrit language to speak of Satchidananda. Even the word Brahma, for example, I told you, the very word Brahman means that which is essence and which expands. Both the meanings are involved in the very word Brahman. Therefore, as Aurobindo says, the Upanishad discovered such words which have this complex meaning. But in other languages, when you say reality is one, we immediately say it can't be many. If you were to say reality is essence, not one, don't say one, you just say it is essence, then you can say it can be many. There can be variation. Because essence remains the same in spite of variation. That is the meaning of essence. So, variation is not opposed to essence. Alright, so, it is that in which all variation, that is word variation, is very important. The entire design of the world, that is what I was saying, we are trying to find out what is the design of the world. So, having done all so far, we have found out that there is one essence in all variations. All variations start from that reality. There is a reality which you cannot describe either as existence nor as non-existence. nor as one, nor as many, nor as one, nor as all, and yet it is all. It is a liberty, it is such a freedom, it is bound neither by freedom nor by bondage. If it is only liberty, it is bound only to liberty. If it is incapable of bondage, it means that it cannot be bound, therefore that limitation exists in him. If he is truly free, that even if he is bound, he still remains free, then only he can really be free. If he is only free and can never become bound, then there is also a limitation. So, such is the reality, such is the omnipresent reality that we see all around. When it is said in the Vedantic Yoga, you should contemplate on the Brahman. So, what is the contemplation? What is the meditation on Brahman? This first paragraph is the meditation on Brahman. Meditate means all ideas which are connected with a subject. Subject must be the same one. In all meditation, meditation is all concentration. When different ideas pertaining to the same subject are all woven together and put together, the process by which all the ideas relevant to that subject are woven together and fixed on that object, that is meditation. So, when we say we ought to contemplate on the Brahman, how shall we contemplate on the Brahman? This is the definition, this is the contemplation. You might say, the first paragraph is the contemplation, dhyana, on the ultimate reality. An omnipresent reality is that, I repeat again, because this is dhyana. In dhyana you can repeat the same word, same words again and again, then only it becomes fixed. An omnipresent reality is the truth of all life in existence, whether absolute or relative, whether corporeal or incorporeal, whether animate or inanimate, whether intelligent or unintelligent, and in all its infinitely varying and even constantly opposed self-expressions. From the contradictions nearest to our ordinary experience to those remotest antinomies which lose themselves on the verges of the ineffable, the reality is one and not a sum or concourse. From that all variations begin. In that all variations consist. To that all variations return. All affirmations are denied only to lead to a wider affirmation of the same reality. All antinomies confront each other in order to recognize one truth in their opposed aspects and embrace by the way of conflict their mutual unity. One of the great antinomies in the world is reality as spaceless and timeless, and reality as space and time. This is one of the antinomies. Reality is timeless and spaceless, and yet you say reality is all time and all space. The two are opposed to each other. And yet it is by these antinomies you try to express that reality. If reality is only space and time, it can't be ultimate, it is limited. If it is only timeless and spaceless, incapable of space and time, it is also limited. If you want to say it is the omnipresent, all reality, without any limitation whatsoever, you have got to say it is spaceless and timeless, it is space and time. Then only you have given a good definition. So all antinomies are all surpassed in that reality. that which is a cause and that which itself is uncaused. Cause of all and itself uncaused is another antonym. It is a cause of all, but itself uncaused. It is free, it is bound. Then only it is beyond freedom and beyond bondage. Then it is truly free. It is unity and yet more than unity. If it is only unity, it is a whole. If it is, but unity has got to be more than unity. The wholeness is achieved because it is the same principle which is manifested in the whole. Therefore, the starting point must be more than that. So it is unity and more than unity. If you really think quite clearly, there is no self-contradiction. It is only when we limit ourselves and use our world as if they are chains, fetters of our thought, then only there is a difficulty. All metaphysical battles, as Sri Aurobindo says, are verbal. If you try to look behind the words and try to see what they really want to indicate, Boris will cease. What is the basic argument of Shankara's Advaita Vedanta? It is also Advaita Vedanta. Sri Aurobindo's philosophy is also Advaita Vedanta. Shankara is also called Advaita Vedanta. What is the difference? According to Shankara, reality being one, it can never be all. Why? Because it is one. Reality is one, therefore it cannot be many. How can it be? If it is one, it can't be many, very clear. Therefore it says, Shankara's philosophy is logically pure, impeccable. Why? Because it says very clearly, if it is one, it can't be many. If it is one, it can't be all. And who can deny this proposition? Logically. And yet it is faulty. On two grounds. First of all, it defines one as a piece of wood, which cannot be many. If it is a piece of wood, if one means piece of wood, then of course you can say it can't be many. But if it is not a piece of wood, if it is essence, then why should variations not arise out of the essence? Therefore, that logic is what Sri Aurobindo calls finite logic. It's a logic which is true of finite objects. There you can argue, if it is only one article, it can't be two. One pebble cannot be two, unless you bring another pebble and add to it, then only it can become two. But this is Krishna who can become Radha himself. He himself is Anya. Such is the nature of reality. So, even though it is said that Shankara's philosophy is logical, you can see that when you go into the depth of it, it ceases to be logical. Not only that, but second difficulty of his logic is that even though he says reality being one can't be all, he admits all exists. He is obliged to admit because multiplicity is seen everywhere.
He says all is an illusion.
Wait a minute. First of all, he says all exists. You cannot deny it. But since all can never have existed, and yet it exists, it means that there must be something wrong. It must be illusion. He does not deny all. He does not deny many. he believes that jiva, the individual, is a fact. Multiplicity is a fact. Therefore he calls it vivaharika satta. All this is a fact. And he does not deny vivaharika satta, practical reality he does not deny. But ultimately, it is not. Therefore it is an illusion. Therefore he gives the example of a rope and snake. To the bewildered man, snake is there. Only when he is awakened he finds it on the rope. But he has seen the snake. Hallucinatorily, he had seen the snake. Similarly he says, you do see that, but you see it in multiplicity. Actually, multiplicity doesn't exist. What you see is only the reality. Now, therefore, it may have to say that Shankaracharya, although Advaitin, he is obliged to accept two things. Ultimate reality and that which appears to be illusion. So, reality is twofold. Not pure Advaita.
That is that
Harik
Satta and
Paramarthik Satta. Yeah, that's right. So, he is obliged to have dualism. And therefore contradictory of his own position. Reality is only one. And yet he ends by saying reality is two. One which is illusory reality and one which is real reality.
And
he said the realities. In this way. One is illusory reality and one is real reality. So it means that it's dualism. Do you follow? Therefore, logically, he is untenable. There are two mistakes in his philosophy, although they are supposed to be logically most impeccable. And yet, impeccable because he says very clearly, one can't be many, one can't be all. Impeccable logic. But then he has got to say all exists, because there's a fact of your existence, you're perceiving all, how can you say no? You see that it is many. Here you do find individuals, X, Y, Z, not only all things, flowers and creatures and mountains, but also individuals. Who are in quest. And there is a tremendous feeling, I am bound. Such human beings do exist. And that is the meaning of individuals. Individual by definition is a particular who has a sense of being bound. This one doesn't have, also this particular does not have the sense it is bound. But you and I are also particulars, but we have the sense that we are bound. For this chapter, it is very necessary to read Shankara's films, although briefly. So, I will take your permission to read two or three paragraphs, which are given by Divine itself, which I consider to be the most authentic exposition of Shankara's verse. It's a chapter called The Reality and the Cosmic Conditions. In the philosophy of Shankara, one feels the presence of a conflict and opposition with this powerful intellect has stated with full force and masterfully arranged rather than solved with any finality. The conflict of an intuition intensely aware of an absolute transcendence in most reality. And a strong intellectual reason regarding the world with a keen and vigorous rational intelligence. The intellect of the thinker regards the phenomenal world from the standpoint of the reason. Reason is there the judge and the authority, and no super-rational authority can prevail against it. But behind the phenomenal world is a transcendent reality which the intuition alone can see. Their reason, at least a finite dividing mandible with limited reason, cannot prevail against the intuitive experience. It cannot even reveal the truth. It cannot therefore solve the mystery of the universe. The reason has to affirm the reality of the phenomenal existence. To affirm its truths as valid, but they are valid only in that phenomenal existence. This phenomenal existence is real because it is a temporal phenomenon of the eternal existence, the reality. But it is not itself that reality. And when we pass beyond the phenomenon to the real, it still exists, but is no longer valid to our consciousness. It is therefore unreal. Shankara takes up this contradiction, this opposition, which is normal to our mental consciousness. When it becomes aware of both sides of existence and stands between them, he resolves it by obliging the reason to recognize its limits, in which its unimpaired sovereignty is left to it within its own cosmic province, and to acquiesce in the soul's intuitions of the transcendent reality, and to support by a dialectic which ends by dissolving the whole falsely phenomenal and rational practical edifice of things, its escape from the limitations constructed and imposed on the mind by Maya. The explanation of cosmic existence by which this is brought about seems to be, or so we may translate it to our understanding, for there have been different expositions of this profound and subtle philosophy, that there is a transcendence which is forever self-existent and immutable, and a world which is only phenomenal and temporary. The eternal reality manifests itself in regard to the phenomenal world as self and Ishwara. The Ishwara by his Maya, his power of phenomenal creation, constructs this world as a temporal phenomenon. And this phenomenon of things, which do not exist in utterly real, is imposed by Maya through our conceptive and perceptive consciousness on the superconscious or purely self-conscious reality. Brahman, the reality, appears in the phenomenal existence as the self of the living individual. But when the individuality of the individual is dissolved by intuitive knowledge, the phenomenal being is released into self-being. It is no longer subject to Maya, and by its release from the appearance of individuality, it is extinguished in the reality. But the world continues to exist without beginning or end as the my creation of Ishwar. This is the best exposition in a few lines. Everything that Shankara has said is masterfully expounded. If it is ununderstandable, we should say it is ununderstandable because that is the very nature of the philosophy, which is ununderstandable. But let us try to understand as much as we can.
It is so clearly understandable, Uncle, that as you said, it's so clearly stated.
Isn't it? Anyone who has studied Shankara will find.
But nobody who has explained Shankara and never explained so
that's what I'm saying, no? That it is so clear.
For my MA, I have specialized in Shankara's philosophies. And I was struggling to expound Shankara's philosophy. But when I read this paragraph, I found I had no other better way of expounding Shankara's philosophy. Now let me try to explain. If you marvel at this exposition, Sri Aurobindo says that Shankara's philosophy can be described as the philosophy of all Veda. Secondly, it can be stated to be a philosophy of Maya or a theory which expounds the origin of the universe in Maya. Therefore, it is Mayava. It is Advaita because it says reality is only one. And you might say, according to Shankara, the expression, what is the ultimate reality, is even not admissible. You should say what is reality, not what is ultimate reality. Because if you say there is an ultimate reality, it means there must be something else, although of a lesser order, but there must be something other than ultimate reality. But if there is only one reality, one without the second, and there is nothing else at all, it must be regarded as reality. What is reality? And yet, he admits that you should speak of ultimate reality. Because there is Maya. And the one reality which exists is other than Maya. Not only other than Maya, but is a source of Maya. Therefore, ultimate reality. So you can justifiably speak of ultimate reality in Shankara's philosophy. And yet you have to say, Shankara admits only, not only, one reality. Now this itself is a kind of a perplexing statement. But as Sri Aurobindo says, you cannot avoid this perplexity because that is what he ultimately says. It is like saying, look, there are two things. He starts by saying, look, there are two things. Then he said, only, not even only, it's one thing. There is a state of consciousness where you find that this world palpably exists. He admits that there is an experience where this world palpably exists. There is the world of multiplicity, which he calls prapancha. This whole world is prapancha. Repetition of fivefold reality. Pancha mahabhutas. So prapancha, it is nothing but repetition of pancha mahabhutas everywhere. The whole world is prapancha. There is much, not only all, there is not only all is nothing but a sum or concourse of all particulars. This world is nothing but particulars. Everything in the world, this flower, everything is particular. Sum of all is the world. Among these, there are some individuals who say, I am bound. Therefore, there is not only all, but there are many. See, it's very interesting that these two words are used in philosophy. All and many. And what is the distinction? All refers to everything that is in the world, every particular in the world, because world consists only of particulars. Everything that we see is only particular. But among these particulars, some experience that they are bound. And there is a large number of such people, therefore they are called many. So, all and many exist, they are undeniably. So, first starting point is that this is the world of all particulars put together. And in this world there are many individuals, jivas. He uses the word jiva also because he is a Vedantic philosophy, and Vedantic philosophy, you must remember, is a commentary on a sutra, which is called Vajrayana Sutra, Vedanta Sutra. And Vajrayana Sutra has been interpreted by all the acharyas who are themselves conversing with each other. That is to say, there is a book which is called Vedanta Sutra. This Vedanta Sutra is nothing but a statement of the summary of Upanishads, but given in aphoristic terms. Aphoristic terms means they are very short sentences which you cannot normally understand without a commentary. So there is a book called Vedanta Sutra which was composed by a philosopher called Vajrayana, who was an authority on Vedanta. In other words, he was an authority of what is contained in the Upanishads. Because Upanishads are called Vedanta. But this Vedanta Sutra is not Upanishad itself. It contains in aphoristic terms the summary and the substance and pith of the Upanishads. Now this Vajrayana Vedanta is a most celebrated work in Indian philosophy. All those who want to understand Upanishads they try to understand through this Vedanta Sutra. But as I said, Sutra itself is aphoristic. You cannot easily understand it. Therefore, in India, there has arisen a series of commentaries on this. Now, all the philosophers who have made commentaries on this Vedanta Sutra are all called Acharyas. And they are all called Vedantins. And five of them are very important ones, and each one of them differs from the other. There is Shankaracharya, Acharya called Shankara, Shankaracharya, Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Vallabhacharya, Nimbarkacharya. And then there is the final is Sri Chaitanya, who is not called Acharya, but he is also a great Vedantin. He gave his own sixth interpretation.
Chaitanya
Mahaprabhu. Now, in the Vedanta Sutra, the following words are used always. Brahman, Ishwara, Maya, Avidya, Jiva, and illusion. These words have been used. Therefore, in all these philosophies, there has got to be commentary upon these six words. So, in Shankara's philosophy also the word jiva is used. And he has his own commentary on the word jiva. So, according to him, the word jiva means that individual who is the agent and the knower. The other particulars are not agents and knowers. There is something special only about these individuals, particulars. We were all particulars, and our special characteristic is that we are knowers and agents of action. Somehow we always feel responsibility lies with sense of responsibility. Because I am the agent of action. I can deny action, I can do the action. And I am the knower. I can cognize objects. Animals, they have cognition, but they don't know they are cognizing. We know we are cognizers. It's a speciality of individuals. So, jiva is characterized by the quality of the agent of action and as a knower. Now, such individuals exist, he cannot deny the fact. You and I, we constantly know and act, we know it very well, nobody can deny it. As Sri Aurobindo says, it is an experience of the reason that this world is present to us. There are jivas also. It is undeniable. As Sri Aurobindo says, to the reason, this is undeniable. But when you enter into a supreme experience of reality, all these exist, but they are invalid. It's a very subtle statement. These things are still seen, but invalid. It's an accurate description of Shankara's philosophy. He doesn't have things evaporate. The prapancha is seeing. You see mountains and rivers and human beings floating about, flitting about. But they are not found to be valid. Now when you ask what is the difference between that which is and yet which is not valid, so he says, Swapna. Swapna is that which is seen, but vanishes when you are awake. It is no more valid. Now you may say that it's not only like Swapna, because Swapna is only analogical issue. Because I see all these things not in Swapna Avastha, I see all in visuals, physical, in waking state I see all this. So he says, it exists but as Vyavaharika. Vyavaharika means that I can deal with that. I can walk on the road, I can talk to people, I can observe things. For my practical affairs, I can transact with them. But ultimately, when I go into that state of consciousness, which is paramarthika, paramartha, paramarthika is paramartha. When I go to the state which is parama, where highest fulfillment is obtained, therefore paramarthi. Artha means the end, ultimate object. So when ultimate end or object is realized, there I find this world still exists. But it is invalid. I don't have any meaning at all. It is somewhat like when you are in a film cinema show going on and you remember something happened in your house. What is happening in the house is quite dreamy. What is very vivid is what is happening in the story before your eyes. That which is there, and when you come out of the cinema show seems to be all melting away and your home again becomes very, very real. These are two different states of consciousness which we all have experienced. So he says that when you go to this paramarthik satta, all this is there but it's having no meaning, no validity. So that which is there but not valid is itself in epistemology a very important category. Normally in epistemology, that which exists must be also valid. That which exists really exists. But that which exists and yet it doesn't have validity, it's a very special category. And Shankara says that there is such a category. He introduces a new category. In the whole philosophical history, he has introduced a new category. Experience of fact, which is not valid. Anyway, this is the position that he says is of this whole world. There, I am no more seeking. Till now I was seeking. I was seeing, thinking I was bound. But there I have found. So how can I be seeking? What I have now found all seeking ceases. What I was seeing, I was bound, bondage ceases, there is no bound, nothing, no bounds at all in now. Ego fails, no more exists there. I don't recognize myself.
So
the Aitma only is Vyavarika. Yeah, Vyavarika, it all ceases. So according to Shankara, in that experience, not only that I cease to be bound, but I find it was never bound. On what study? That reality. When I really see it was never bound. That which was embedded in my experience, that was bound. But that reality was never bound. And that reality was never seeking to be free. It was always free. That one which was seeking is invalid.
What Shankara is saying, is it the same what the other five are saying about that?
No. This is where the difference lies. This is purely Shankara's interpretation.
Look at what you said about Vajrayana Sutra. You said that the word illusion and Maya is there.
Words are used. There was illusion. There is.
And is Maya and illusion concurrent in the other philosophies? Or
also, they also use the word Maya.
Meaning they interpretation.
The words are used. That is why these two words have become very famous in our country.
No, but in the Vajrayana Sutra, the word illusion is there.
There, yes.
But how do they use the word illusion? It's not there in Upanishads at all. And where does it come from? It is there in Upanishads.
No, there is, it is true. Even the word Maya is once or twice used in the Upanishads. But in Shankara's philosophy, it has become strong enough. So now, at that time, the word also as it was there, is there but is no more valid. And ultimately you can withdraw from this to such an extent forever and ever you can go to the inactive reality. And there is no prapancha at all, no individual at all. It's a pure luminosity, complete quietude. Inactive Brahman is a real experience. And such is the reality. Now this is all that is Shankara's basic philosophy. Now having done this, two or three questions remain for Shankara to answer. This world, prapancha, is certainly present to all of us. You give to it paramarthika satta, distinguished from it to vyavarik satta. You say it is vyavarik satta. Satta means existing. So it's not something not existing. It exists. But vyavarika, only practical purpose it exists. So the question is, can you explain how this vyavarik world came to exist? If you at all say it exists, if you say it never existed, does not exist, you never saw it, then there is no question of explaining it. But Shankara does admit that this world exists. Although ultimately found to be invalid, but it exists. If it exists, the question is, how did it come to exist? So his answer is that there is a power. That power is called Maya. And that power creates this world. This is one answer. Now you ask further. Where is this Maya? It must be in the Brahman, because Brahman is only reality. So answer is, Maya is in the Brahman. Logically, he has got to answer that if Maya, even for temporary being, creates this world, it must have somewhere locus of it. So he admits, Maya is in Brahman. And he admits that all this world is nothing but which has a source in Brahman. He doesn't deny it, because how can you deny if there is only one reality? You have got to say that this world comes out of the Brahman. Who is individual? Who is bound and all this struggling? You and I who are trying to find out Shankara's philosophy, trying to be liberated, who are we? So he says, we all individuals have two parts, body, life and mind. And there is a jiva. Jiva identifies itself with body, life and mind. This is what he calls adhyasa.
Adhyasa.
Superimposition of body, life and mind on the jiva is called adhyasa. How does it come to do adhyasa? It is not itself the body, life and mind. But how does it come to superimpose? There must be a power which superimposes. That power by which superimposition is made is called avidya. Avidya is ignorance. There is a power of ignorance. It's a power which creates body, life and mind. In that respect is Maya. It creates body, life and mind. So all body, life and mind is actually created as parts of the world, prapancha. So, avidya participates like Maya, is the same as Maya, creates body, life and mind. Then it does second aspect, not only creates, but superimposes body, life and mind on jiva. It projects and superimposes. It's a creative power, it is a power of superimposition. It is avidya. Not only that, but this power, avidya, not only superimposes body, life and mind on jiva, but even superimposes the whole world on the reality. Not on jiva, but also on the reality. Body, life and mind, I superimpose upon my jiva. But the whole world, I superimposed upon the whole world.
On reality.
On the reality. Therefore, when I look about in the whole world, I don't see the reality. I only see prapancha. And as far as my body life and mind are concerned, they are superimposed upon myself, therefore I don't see myself actually. I am ignorant of myself. I am jiva. Now what happens further? When I am awakened, and this is a long process of awakening. And what is the process of awakening? I must first study Vedanta. It's a path of method of awakening. You may also call it Shruti. I hear. You must have the hearing of the word Brahma. And you must create in you the desire to know the Brahman. Therefore, Vedanta Sutra begins with Atha Brahma Jigyasa. You start with this. I begin with this. I want to know the Brahman. Then, I learn Vedanta and I find that this world, I myself, all that I am thinking, is due to ignorance. I am ignorant. It's another awakening. All this, but as long as you are really ignorant, you don't even suspect that you are ignorant. I was in the beginning not even suspecting that I am ignorant. So now, when I read the Vedanta, I become awakened that I am ignorant. And because of ignorance, I see all multiplicity and all, actually speaking, there is only one reality, Brahman, which is one without the second, luminous, which is Satchidananda, absolutely quiet and silent. This is what I come to learn. So first of all, I learn it in the form of thought, vichara. Now this vichara is first of all a vichara which dwells upon discrimination. I now come to see that this Brahman is different from all that I see. So viveka is a first and fundamental thing to do. Which is where Shankaracharya wrote a book called Viveka Chulamani. You discriminate between the Brahman, which is one, and the world, which is multiple. Brahman, which is unborn, and Jiva, which thinks I am born, and Jiva, which believes that I am body, life and mind. Whereas there is nobody born, and there is no body, life and mind and nothing to superimpose. All this is grasped in my thought. Now this grasp is to be considered manana. Shravana followed by manana. Between Shravana and Manana, all this vichara, power of vichara, viveka, is involved. Then you think about it, manana. You sit down every day and say, I am not the body, I am not the life, I am not the body, I am not the life, I am not the mind, I am not the ego. I am, this is negative, I am the Brahman, I am the Brahman, I am the Brahman. Repeats, manana, constantly repeats. Also repeat, this world is a superimposition upon the Brahman. This world does not exist. This world is not the Brahman. Discriminate between this world and the Brahman. Then say, the Brahman is not this world. This world is not the Brahman. Constantly reflect upon this. Then, nididhyasana. Go on and on and on. All the time remain meditating upon it, constantly. Nididhyasana. Then it promises, if you do it, you will have, by this very process, one day, all this will disappear. All this will come to be invalid. This is the promise of yoga. It does happen. This is verified. If you follow this method, this is the method. If you follow this method, a day will come when you will be awakened. And you will find we have no more body, life and mind. There are no more in this world. This world doesn't exist. It's not valid. We may see the world. There's no more valid. What is valid is only stupendous silence. Nishabda. Wordless silence. For some time you may say that all this is invalid and therefore you say this is invalid. At a higher stage, your message is Tuccha, trifle. Some other higher stage, you may choose to show Tuccha, or trifle. At a still higher level, you say, it's no more there at all. There is no more reference to it even. If it doesn't exist, how can you refer to it? And then if you ask the question, how did all this come about? Answer is, whatever answers I had given earlier are all to be cancelled. How can the Brahman, which is absolutely stupendous silence, how can the Maya doesn't exist? Therefore, to say that all this came out of Maya, this answer is to be cancelled. You may not even cancel it, but there is no need of it.
Right.
It's not there at all. So what is to be cancelled? You said, but earlier you said Maya, when? There is only eternity here. There was no time when Maya existed, no time when you asked this question, no time when I answered this question.
Because time only doesn't exist in there.
Time itself doesn't exist
for you.
If you still insist, I have to say, my dear friend, it can't be explained. It is inexplicable. A philosophy which aims at explaining ultimately answers what is inexplicable. This world could have never come into existence. It has never come into existence. Yet, it stares at you Therefore, you can say, this world is inexplicable, Abhyasa is inexplicable, your jivahood is inexplicable, your seeking of freedom is inexplicable, it never existed, none is bound, none to be freed. It's only ever free Brahman. And there is no other answer possible. Can you give any other answer? There is no other answer possible. Now this is, you might say, Shankara's philosophy, whether it's satisfied or not satisfied. But this is all that is, that can be said at the most. I think we can stop here today, but we shall continue because this is so important for this chapter.